Live on tape from the Pioneer 90.1 FM KSRQ studios at the Center for New Media at Northland College in Thief River Falls and streaming worldwide at RadioNorthland.org, it's the independent pro wrestling in Minnesota show. With your host, hailing from somewhere in the extreme northwestern corner of Minnesota, Glenn Broggett.
Hello again and welcome to Independent Pro Wrestling in Minnesota. I'm your host, Glenn Broggett. On today's show, we'll be playing part two of an interview I did with professional wrestling historian and author of a great book about the history of professional wrestling in the state of Minnesota called Minnesota's Golden Age of Wrestling from Vern Gagne to the Road Warriors, a fellow by the name of George Shire. And in part one of the show last week, we played a half hour of George talking about the early days of professional wrestling and its relationship to the state of Minnesota. We talked a little bit about Gorgeous George, and of course, we talked about Mr. Vern Gagne. On today's show, we'll go even further into the history of professional wrestling in Minnesota, as well as the history of the American Wrestling Association. Let's get back into the interview with George Shire on independent pro wrestling in Minnesota. And another thing, too, that really took off up in Minnesota in the pro wrestling scene, and it was really one of the first big areas of the country where tag team wrestling took off, too. Now, how did that all come about, and who were some of the more memorable tag teams of that late 50s into the early 60s era of wrestling in Minnesota and with the AWA, too?
Well, tag team wrestling really took a hold in the early 50s. It was kind of a thing where promoters decided that, you know, if we got a good guy and a bad guy that we can put against each other, well, what if we put two bad guys together against two good guys and, you know, come up with some rules? And the rules were simple. They, you know, the partners would stand on the ring apron, and one guy would be in the ring from each team, and the one outside the ring had to hold what they called a tag rope. It was just a small rope that was tied to the turnbuckle. And the idea was that he couldn't come in until his partner tagged his hand, and he'd come in, and, you know, that's the way it went. Well, of course, it was meant to be, the rules were meant to be broken. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, sometimes you'd have the two bad guys in the ring while the referee was busy trying to keep the other good guy out, and the two bad guys would be beating on one wrestler, and the fans are getting irritated because the referee's not seeing it, and sometimes they miss a tag, and the referee didn't see that. And oh, I mean, it's just whatever they could do to frustrate the fans and, you know, make them want to come back next week or next month, whatever the next card was.
And let's talk about some of these great tag teams. And another great homegrown Minnesota State guy, you know, you talk about Vern, but, you know, another guy that came out of the early 60s with his great tag team with Harley Race was Larry Henning, the Axe.
Well, there you go. And, you know, in the early years, Larry Henning was one of the things that Vern really contributed to the wrestling world as a whole was all of the many, many wrestlers that he trained for the business. One of the things that Vern always emphasized when he on his wrestling cards is he wanted any wrestler that basically worked for him to have a fundamental background in the wrestling business. Maybe knew how to protect himself and actually be a wrestler, and then we'll add the character and the costumes and whatever to it. Larry Henning was one of his first trainees. Larry was trained by Vern in 1957 and 58, and for about two or three years, Larry was the guy that hauled the ring around to all the different cities. You know, he'd put the ring up. If they came up to your city in Thief River Falls, he'd be the guy that would get there early and get the ring set up, and a lot of that, and then he'd work with the wrestlers. And Larry, for a couple of years, was like a substitute. So if someone didn't show up on a card or someone really was hurt or unable to work that night, Larry was the guy they stuck in. And Larry got a lot of experience. But one of the things about Larry and Vern is that Larry was a much bigger guy. He was he made a better heel than he did a good guy in those early years anyway. And so about 1962... they started changing the attitude of Larry Henning in the ring, and he was no longer a popular wrestler and associated with Vern. He became more the arrogant bully. And then he hooked up with Harley Race in 1964, And that was box office magic. That was what a promoter would call, we have just found the golden egg here. Because together, the two of them, Pretty Boy Larry Hennig and Handsome Harley Race, and they could irritate the fans more than anyone. And, I mean, you talked about the feminine side that Gorgeous George threw into it. Hennig and Race would come out on their interviews, and they would both brag that they had the bodies of Hercules and the minds of Einsteins and the face of the goddess of love. You know, and we have the body that men fear and women crave, you know, Harley Race would say. Well, all those things on their interviews would be just that much more reason that the fans would flock to the arena to see the baby face try to just kick their butts, you know, and that's what it was all about.
And we're talking with George Shire. He's a great author of a fantastic book called Minnesota's Golden Age of Wrestling here on Independent Wrestling in Minnesota. And we were talking about some homegrown talent, talking about the tag team division that really started to catch fire in the 50s and 60s. And when I bring up the name Mad Dog Vachon, what does that bring for you, great memory-wise?
Well, Mad Dog Vachon, you know, there is another guy, kind of a similar background to Gorgeous George in that he wrestled for, Mad Dog wrestled for about 10 years before he really started to gain the fame that we all knew he had, you know, that we all saw later on. In his early years, he was just plain Maurice Vachon, and he was a babyface. He didn't have much color to him. He didn't have, you know, much personality. But he was in Portland, Oregon, wrestling for a promoter by the name of Don Owens. And Don Owens, when we talk about promoters, if we ever talk about promoters, he was one of the best there was. Well, Don Owens had Maurice Vachon on his card, and for whatever reason, they wanted to try Maurice Vachon as kind of a bad guy, see if they could kind of turn him. And what Maurice did during his match was he started biting his opponent, and he started scratching his back with his with his fingers. And promoter Don Owens made the comment, he says, I don't know what we're going to do with this guy. He's in there. He's acting like a mad dog. Well, the mad dog part, accidentally, right there, that was his name, and they started billing him as Mad Dog Vachon. He was magic for Vern Gagne because, again, you have Vern Gagne. I know we've said it a couple of times, but the all-American good guy. And then you bring in this heel, growling, snarling, scratching, biting opponent. And Mad Dog, they created a story about him that he grew up in the streets of Algeria starving, and he came to this country to get the world championship. So what they never told people was that he was actually from Canada, and he was a legitimate wrestler before he became professional, and he represented Canada in the 1948 Olympics. So he and Vern Gagne knew each other. And now they created this great program between the two of them where Mad Dog was going to get Vern's title, and he did for a few years. They had great, great matches all over the AWA territory. Whenever Vern and Mad Dog would wrestle, you could count on probably a sellout in the arena you were at.
Oh, man, Mad Dog Vachon. There's another one that I remember from my early days of wrestling. I was just gravitated to him because he had such charisma and that voice, that growl, that everything. That was a guy that was, like you said, he was cash money.
Oh, and that's exactly what you needed. And then in 1965, when the Crusher turned from a heel to a baby face, well, that was another natural to put the Crusher against the Mad Dog. And they had blood matches all over the AWA. They made great money with each other. And then in the 70s, they actually, when Mad Dog turned good guy, then they teamed up. So it was always great to follow the storylines, how they made things happen.
Absolutely.
Ray, do the hammer. Yeah. your partner's head. Just strip through the face.
We're going to talk a little bit about the mask wrestlers. Now, talk about another movement of wrestler that made its way through wrestling in Minnesota in the 1960s. Very important part of the pro wrestling landscape in the AWA, both in the 60s and 70s.
Well, that was a great gimmick that obviously has been gone for about 20 years now, but that was a great gimmick in wrestling. There were times when a wrestler maybe wasn't making any big money just being his normal self. Promoter could put a mask on him. Claims that they didn't know where he came from. I always loved it when they announced that they were from parts unknown. And what fans didn't know in that era was that in every territory around the country, at one time or another, every territory had a masked wrestler. Mm-hmm. And so there were a lot of people that came from that parts unknown, wherever that was. But the mask gimmick was great because you'd get fans to come to the arena supposedly to try to find out who this guy was. Who's going to be able to unmask him? Why is he masked? Well, a lot of times they'd say they were masked because they couldn't get matches under their real name because wrestlers feared them, so they put a mask on, and now they're getting matches. And they had great names. Like, you know, we had our Mr. M, and we had Dr. X, and there were names all over, the Infernos and the Assassin and the Avenger and, you know, you name it, they had a name. The Spoiler, the Super Destroyer. And Dr. X, though, in the book, and Mr. M, Bill Miller, I talk great in great detail about those two because they were our two most famous masked men here. And their stories are legendary as to how they were both great wrestlers. And when they put those masks on, they even did a little bit better than they did when they didn't have it on.
Mm-hmm. It's just great, great, solid workers. And we moved into the decade of the 70s for professional wrestling in Minnesota and the AWA. As I was reading your great book, Minnesota's Golden Age of Wrestling from Vern Gagne to the Road Warriors. Now, there was a lot of great wrestlers that got some of their first major pushes in the AWA. We're talking about guys like, you know, Wahoo McDaniel, you know, Superstar Billy Graham. I mean, the Texas Outlaws, Dusty Rhodes and Dick Murdoch definitely got some great fame. And you got even guys like up-and-comers like your Don Morocco's, your Bobby Duncombe's and Billy Robinson. And this was a really good ground for wrestlers to get their first major pushes and then move on to even greater things.
Well, this is a true story, Glenn. You know, I had mentioned earlier that there were so many different territories around the United States. At any given time, there were probably 30 territories. And so wrestling was being run every single night of the week somewhere in the United States, and sometimes many cards on a given night. We never knew about what was going on in St. Louis or Tampa, Florida, or Houston, Texas, or Sacramento, California. But we knew what was going on here. And there were so many wrestlers. In that era, there were probably 3,000 wrestlers that were able to travel around the country. And I will tell you that they did it by car a lot in those years. And they'd travel, they'd wrestle 300 to 365 nights a year. And They would go from town to town. They were like, I always reference the Willie Nelson song, On the Road Again,
mm-hmm.
if you're familiar with that, where Willie says, like a band of gypsies, we go down the highway. Well, that's what these wrestlers were. They would be six of them that would pile into a big old 98, and they'd head down the freeway, go 200, 250 miles to the next town so they could put on their show. They'd wrestle. They'd get paid. Or as they, a lot of them would say, we hoped we got paid, so we didn't have a shyster promoter. We hoped we got paid. We'd go back to the hotel with a six-pack of beer and some bologna sandwiches, sleep, and go get up and start it all over for the next night. And that's what they did for day in and day out.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the wrestlers, a lot of them got their starts in certain territories, but Vern trained so many. We mentioned Larry Hennig.
Yep.
Don Morocco, when he came here, and you just mentioned his name, when Don Morocco came here, he had been in the business about 6 months, and he had basically come here to get training from Vern Gagne. Now, Vern didn't train him in his camp like he did a lot of wrestlers, but Don Morocco worked with Vern and then teamed and worked with Billy Robinson. Now, you know what a great wrestler and technician that Billy Robinson was.
Oh, absolutely.
So it was no doubt that Don Morocco was going to be good. And then all of these wrestlers, when they'd work in these territories, they would not only work with their opponents, tag with their partners, but they would watch the matches, and they'd look at different techniques and moves and how they did this and how the fans reacted to that, and they learn from each other. They create their character. I don't know if you remember the name Bob Windham.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. The man who later on went on to even with the great fame as Blackjack Mulligan.
There you go. Bob Windham came to Vern Gagne in 1969 and 70. He had only had a few matches down in Texas after he left football. And he came up to Vern. He worked with Vern as a referee. He was one of those guys that carried the ring around town to town. He wrestled with a lot of the opponents. Vern trained him, worked with him. When he left in 1971, he went out east to the WWWF, which it was at that time, and became Blackjack Mulligan. And then the rest of his career, the guy was a main eventer, but he got his early training from Vern.
Mm-hmm. And he went on to just huge fame, especially in the Carolinas, and like Ric Flair. Speaking of Vern Gagne trainees,
oh, yeah.
Ric Flair. I mean, that guy, how could we not talk about Flair? That was one of the guys that made it through Vern's camp. Ricky Steamboat, there was a whole host of them that came out of Vern's training camps in the 1970s.
If you made a list, and Greg Gagne and I did this about a year ago, you made a list of all of the wrestlers that Vern trained and brought into the business, and then you looked at about a 20 to 25-year span in the business of how it would have been different had these wrestlers not made it in the business and with Vern's influence. It would be sad that they didn't make it. Ric Flair, Larry Hennig, Lanza, Blackjack Lanza,
oh,
Blackjack
yeah.
Mulligan. I mentioned Don Morocco. You had the three Anderson brothers, Gene, Lars, and Ole. All three of them came through Vern Gagne's camp. Jim Brunzel, Greg Gagne, Baron Von Raschke. Those are just some of the bigger names, but we're talking guys that all over this business made it, and it was Vern's influence.
Mm-hmm. And another thing, if I have to look back at the 70s and sum up some of the bigger moments of the 70s, it has to be, as far as the AWA goes, the rise of Nick Bockwinkel and the Bobby Heenan family. Now, Nick Bockwinkel, he came in the early part of the decade. He really, really attained superstar status in the AWA with a great run as a champion, both as a singles champion, a tag team champion, and his fantastic feuds with both Vern and son Greg and Jimmy Brunzel, too. I mean, Nick Bockwinkel, if you want to call somebody an MVP award of the 1970s AWA wrestling scene, it would have to be him.
Well, and you're definitely right. And, there's another great story, because Nick Bockwinkel grew up around the business. His dad, Warren Bockwinkel, was a wrestler in the 40s and the very early 50s. And when Nick Bockwinkel wanted to become a pro, in his late teens, he hooked up with his dad and Wilbur Snyder and got training. He worked with Lou Thesz to be trained. And in Nick Bockwinkel, when he made his pro debut in about 1954, he basically was a babyface in most territories he wrestled in. He was like mid-card, really wasn't setting any great fires, and getting anyone excited as a babyface. But in 1969, he went to Atlanta. And he decided he was going to be a heel. Well, that's where he started to put that persona of the arrogant, the very cocky, the very quiet. Nick Bockwinkel was a heel that never shouted on his interviews. He never raved and ranted like a lot of them did. He was more calm and collected and just sort of irritated you. And when 1970, he had been contacted by Vern to come in to the AWA, and he and Vern had been friends and struck up a great working relationship together. And Vern basically was, it was an honor when Nick was trusted with Vern's title for as long as he was. But, here was how Nick Bockwinkel really got started, his very first night on All-Star Wrestling, and I will remember this forever, it was December 10th, 1970. Marty O'Neill interviewed Nick Bockwinkel for the very first time, and Nick came out, and as quiet and calm and collected as he could, Marty said, "Why are you here, Nick Bockwinkel?" He said, "I've been a wrestler for over 10 years. I've chased the champion, and the champion has avoided me." He said, "In the Hawaii, where I was the state champion, when someone is leaving, we say aloha." And then Nick looked right at the camera, and he said, "Aloha, Vern Gagne."
Bam. That's
meaning Vern is done. And they built the feud between them right there. And in 1975, Vern was slowing down in his own career and wanted to take care of some of the business end of wrestling, because behind the scenes, Vern was always the promoter, something the fans never knew. They only knew him as the wrestler. And Wally Carbo was his partner, but Wally Carbo was the stooge, the on-camera guy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
And so Vern wanted to take some time off, and obviously he was starting to get up in the years a little bit, and they decided that Nick was the heir apparent. And for the next almost 5 years, Nick carried the championship to greater lengths, as you said, with feuds and teaming up with Bobby Heenan. Nick was one of those rare guys, Glenn, that didn't need a manager, a mouthpiece, because he was good on the microphone himself. But putting him with Bobby Heenan was just promotion genius.
Oh, absolutely.
The two of them together made tons of money.
Box office right there. Box office indeed.
Former world champ Nick Bockwinkel, Bobby Heenan, here on California soil again, gentlemen.
Yes, our homeland. Now, you know, I heard Tito Santana out here a little bit earlier saying he's thinking of making the Bay Area his home. Now, that's a little bit of euphemistic.
Oh, that property value would go down.
Oh, wouldn't it?
Oh, gentlemen,
now,
please.
Now, if he feels he's got to say something like that to win the hearts of you humanoids, you simpletons, that's okay. That's understandable. Now, I have no desire to impress you at all. Mr. Heenan has no desire to impress you. We could care less about impressing anyone. All we want is Vern Gagne, the former world's heavyweight champion. I say former because I'm thinking positive and I'm thinking into the future. This man stole the title from me in Chicago. And I only want all the wrestling fans throughout the world to put the pressure on him to step back into the ring to give me a return match, because the championship is really mine. The only person I want to impress is myself and Mr. Heenan, and we're going to do it in our style.
Bobby Heenan, that is a very good-looking sport coat you've got on.
Yeah, and I paid for mine. Mine is in government issue.
Oh,
go ahead, interview me now. That's your job out here.
Bobby
People
Heenan.
Like to know a little bit about me.
Yes.
You're the kind of a guy that just keeps talking, don't let anybody else get a word in. Now, interview me while I can get my interview done here.
I like it.
And don't waste any time talking about other little things that are trivial. Talk to me right now. Go ahead. Come on.
Bobby.
You know, I got a lot to say. I'm not the kind of a guy that stands around here. You bring Vern Gagne out here, the world's heavyweight champ. You bring whoever else you want out here, and I'm going to put this man right against him. They talk about how bad Bockwinkel wants the belt, how he walks his rooms at night, how he stays by the phone waiting for someone to call, waiting for Vern Gagne to break a hip or something, how he drives by where Vern Gagne stays in the motel in the house and rolls the windows down, and he's yelling, trying to sucker him out of the motel room, how he polishes an old belt he's got at home, how he cries day and night. Wrong. Not day and night. Not week and week out. He's a champion. He don't have to do that stuff.
Are you done yet?
No, I'm not done. Keep going.
We're out of time.
Out of time?
I'm sorry to say, you better believe it.
What do you think, I'm standing
We're
going to
be right
help?
Back with more action.
Boy, you...
This concludes part two of my interview with professional wrestling historian and author George Shire on Independent Pro Wrestling in Minnesota. Coming up on our next edition of the show will be the third and final part of this very interesting and fascinating look into the history of professional wrestling in Minnesota with Mr. Shire. Coming up on the next edition, we hear about the final years of Vern Gagne and the AWA in the state of Minnesota, as well as find out a few things about the indie promotions that were popping up right after the AWA's untimely demise. It should be a great, great, great show. Next edition here on the Independent Pro Wrestling and Minnesota show. And coming up here, before we go, we're going to play one more classic interview featuring Bobby the Brain Heenan and, of course, Slick Nick Bockwinkel. The two of them were probably the best 1-2 combination as far as interviews and charisma go in the AWA in the 1970s up into the early 1980s as well. And in this final interview, I'm going to play from Heenan and Bockwinkel. They're going to talk about the sleeper hold, because Vern Gagne, well known for the Gagne sleeper, Bockwinkel started doing the sleeper too. And there was great debate among many a fan back in the day about whether Vern's or Nick's were chokeholds. So Nick is going to explain his Bockwinkel sleeper, and we're going to finish off the show with that fun little interview from the early 1980s featuring announcer Ken Resnick.
Fans, I've had a chance to catch the world's heavyweight champion Nick Bockwinkel and talk to him before he left for his championship defenses scheduled for the Far East. Nick Bockwinkel, let me ask you, there's still all around the country quite a bit of controversy about the submission hold, the sleeper.
Well, one of the things that is so controversial is that the Los Angeles Police Department have told their officers they no longer can use it because they've had 12 incidents and cases of people being permanently injured, and so it's taboo. And it is a hold that no one should use. It basically, Bobby, take the mic. What we're talking about is the edge of this bone on your forearm, the ulna. It goes across the carotid artery right here on the side of the neck. We're cutting off the blood to the head. And so that when you take and you put it there, okay? Now, as we do know, Mr. Gagne for years has used the sleeper. But what a lot of people don't know, bring the camera in close. As you can see, my arm is on the side. Mr. Gagne, when he gets it, he swings it around. Now look where my forearm is. It's across the throat. I've just got one arm, and the poor man's choking to death. He has spent years choking people down rather than applying it on the side, then here, bringing it in, and the leverage. Now this man, if we hold on to him a little longer and put the pressure on, he's going to go nighty-night. But we wouldn't want to do that to the man, would we?
No. You know, everybody in professional wrestling for years, here, you make yourself useful. Everybody in professional wrestling for years talked about Gagne's sleeper. What a great hold it was. We were the only ones that made any stink about it because everybody knew and we knew it was a chokehold. Now, because you've been so victorious with and successful with it, everybody's screaming now, it's a chokehold. Well, like Mr. Bockwinkel said, Gagne moved his arm over just a little bit.
On the side, right there. This is the Gagne sleeper. This is the Mr. Bockwinkel sleeper. And I would want to say this to the championship committee. We would find it outrageous that you would take and bar the hold at this time simply for the fact that we've been so successful. Everybody seemed to turn their head when Mr. Gagne did it for years. And Greg Gagne still does it the same way.
Now, may I suggest this, that the children out there watching, they don't apply this to one another because it could cause permanent brain damage. No, same goes for the old ladies and everybody else out there that's interested in putting the sleeper on. It's nothing to play with. And I'll tell you another thing, it's nothing to play with, and that's the Heenan family.
Independent Pro Wrestling in Minnesota is recorded live on tape at Pioneer 90.1 KSRQ Studios in Thief River Falls, Minnesota. Independent Pro Wrestling in Minnesota is a CTC Select Worldwide Production 2011.